I would say this to you if she weren't here, but she's one of my favorites. All right, well, now's the chance for you to keep me honest. Any questions or reflections? Yes.
Could you say something more about the societal aspect of evil?
Yes, let's start by saying, no matter what you hear in terms of the press, this is not a Christian nation. It's very much secular. Even when you read about the founding fathers, they were theists, not Christians. And a theist very simply believes that there's some divine entity, but that's about it. You know? So there are a lot of well-meaning people who are trying to have a revisionist sense of history of saying, well, actually, no, we're founded on Christian principles. It's not true. Okay. So in the larger context of what we're dealing with here, I think what happens is something similar to what this biologist did in an experiment. And I'll start with a little image. There's an enterprising biologist who was studying frogs. And what he did was he took the temperature, the mean temperature of the liquids inside a frog's body. And then he got a beaker full of water and got it to the same temperature and put the frog inside. What do you think the frog did? Stayed inside, swimming along, having a good old time. Okay, everyone's walking, coming to the top, but just enjoy it. Because remember, it was the same same temperature. But then the biologist said, well, what would happen if I were to boil the water? Mm-hmm. And put the frog in. What do you think the frog did?
Nice.
Jumped right out. Pretty smart frog, huh? So he went back to the first part of the experiment, took the same beaker, same temperature that the frog's liquids were in. He put the frog in, and he put it over a flame. And he turned it way down low. And he just monitored the temperature. What do you think the frog did? Exactly. Stayed in the beaker until he died. Okay. I use that image because that's what often happens in a community or society, is that St. Ignatius is the one who said this. It's very rare someone who's serious about the spiritual life cannot or does not recognize outright evil. Okay? It's these kind of things that it's like, well, you know, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. You know, or that's his personality, or, you know, it's just the way she is. But it's recognized the temperature is being turned up more and more on so many levels. Now, before you say, oh yeah, the rise in pornography or this or that, those are what we'd call the hot evil. This is primarily geared to the side that most of us don't talk about, cold evil. All right, the frozen feelings, like the story about the woman and her son Charlie, okay, about the couple with the gun and their son. Those type of things are just as evil as the hot, passionate things that you say you do in a moment of being kind of crazed. So society-wide, this is my read of it, is I think we're very immature. Not only in the way that we approach evil, we tend to make it into movies and whatnot. We get excited about, like, say, demons that can turn our necks around and stuff like that. When that is so rare, it's a waste of time to look at it. But this is much more common. We're willing to look at. Yes.
I happened to turn on CNN last night, and Soledad O'Brien was saying that the government of Haiti wants to tax all the supplies that are coming into the country that are being donated. To me, that's evil.
Yeah. That's obviously preying on the great human need, yeah.
It could be a great idea. I mean, they have absolutely no money to make decisions on their own. They have to let the outside make their decisions because they hold the purse strings. If they tax that, then they would have money to start to build their rebuild their justice system, their roads, their and be the agent for their own nation.
But they have a corrupt government, so it's not going to people.
I'm not sure that is. I wouldn't be assured of that.
Where
did
go before
they are married? I mean, what government isn't
corrupt? I just had this uncomfortable feeling of being the frog in the beaker, the first beaker when I spoke, because what I was thinking was what Don said, but I just stayed in that little beaker.
And heated up.
Yes. Says Mary, who's been down to Haiti and allowed herself to see the situation face to face. You're not somebody who stays in it because.
And what you say.
So you just speak from first-hand experience.
Yeah.
Barry, you speak from first-hand experience. She's been down there. She's saying that she's agreeing with Don. Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where when you get used to an environment or a situation, if it works for you one way or another, then why should you question it? And that's why people who come in and begin to question it, we tend, if we're not willing to listen to them, we tend to demonize them, and we tend to somehow to put them to death and silence their words. And look at the way we've been polarized, both in the church and in our political parties. And you can't have a decent conversation with people. I just throw out a name, it's like, oh, you must be. And it's like, okay, that ends the discussion. When I was in Australia, I was really touched by the fact that Australians laugh when we call them spiritual because they don't consider themselves spiritual at all. But you know, in their public media, they have what we would call religious discussions. And they don't demonize each other. They have some really solid discussions. In fact, the Anglican bishop there has what he calls, I think it's called Market Encounter, where he literally sits in his plaza and he brings, like, say, a scientist, whatever the topic is, a scientist or two from a different field, and they talk about really important issues. And people from all around just come in at lunchtime to stand and listen to the conversation. Can you ever think of something like that out here in America? No, he said, oh, you can't get faith and reason to talk. But it's that type of thing where we've fallen into this, where we call it, we think this is politics as it should be, and it's not. We have slipped into not listening to each other.
Well, I was watching the healthcare conference, and it was really interesting because some commentators would say, oh, well, this is just people grandstanding, one, you know, truth and opposite. And another person would say, no, some real, if you really listen, you could learn a lot from the discussion that's going on. So I was thinking, it's probably a matter of our perception. If we think all the government of Haiti is evil and bad, then giving them money would be bad. But maybe it's not all, they can change as well as we can change, or maybe even our politicians, what we bring to it allows us to be learners or condemners.
Yeah. And again, that all or nothing thinking is immature. We have to be able to stand with the greatness that, like Don was saying, every country's government at some level is going to be corrupt. Why should we expect that ours is not? But at the same time, there are members who are good people who are really trying to do the best they can. It's not saying that they can't be corrupted later on, but they're trying. So we want to remember the enemy of all this is the continuing practice of the good. Not just saying, oh, they're all bad or evil or wrong. It's like, okay, well, your best witness is you do good. How can you do that? Mm-hmm. How can you live it out in a way that affirms the goodness that you're trying to model?
When President Obama, referring to the conference, when President Obama came in this morning, I watched about an hour of the conference on Tuesday. He greeted every one of those present there and said some little thing to each one. And he opened it with a real sense of wanting to listen to everybody. So everybody was respected in the group. And so he set a tone. If I was cynical, I would say, yeah, right, well, wait till he really says what he's thinking, or wait till they're all going to start. I had to turn it off before I found out. I don't know. But he's trying to bring about that sense of respect.
Yes.
Where does mental illness also play into this? I find it's difficult. I counsel people a lot and spiritually, but sometimes it's very difficult to know what is evil and what is mental illness?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Mm-hmm. Let me just kind of talk around it a bit. First off, illness itself is seen as an incompletion or an imperfection of, if you will, God's plan. It's a part of our reality. And this is why that when Jesus was confronted with illness, he would cure it. He would bring something, if not a cure, then a healing or consolation. I mean, that presence, that divine presence. I love the quote by St. Thomas More. He said, it's not so much that God stands with us in our suffering. Rather, God suffuses God's own divine presence for the suffering. So that that suffering itself becomes God's presence for us. And to pay attention to it.
Excuse me, what did you just say?
Thomas More said, he said, it's not so much that God stands with us in our suffering, rather he suffuses our suffering with his own divine presence.
He fills it.
That's his word, not mine. Suffuses. Fills it with his presence. Mm-hmm. So, having said that, this is just one holy person saying it, is it possible that the illness, the infirmity, the weakness itself is speaking to us about some aspect of God, what we might call the hidden aspect of God? So, what does it mean that God has chosen to be weak? Ill. Isn't that what the cross is about? Okay. So with that as a starting point, a good image that was given to me is to think of this, that when you have any type of human wound, if it goes uncared for, if it's not addressed, then what can happen is even one can act like a hawk, so to speak, and just come and sit right on that wound and exacerbate the wound. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that's what you're alluding to, is that it's hard to discern, is there some evil here? Where does the wound begin and evil begin? It can work together, yes. Mm-hmm. And at least in my experience of ministry, I would say that very often the individual begins to over-identify with the wound. In secular society, we call this a victim mentality. Mm-hmm. But that's where the evil one can jump on the bandwagon and say, yeah, that's all you are. Remember when Jesus said, do not judge? Mm-hmm. What that means, very simply, is, using our language, is you can say that that's a lie, but to say you're a liar, you've over-identified sin and weakness for this person. You're saying that's all you are. Okay? And Christ is saying that's not true. That's not the way my Father sees this person. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. On the way over this morning, I was listening to NPR, and they were talking about sexual addiction and referred, and had a little clip of Tiger Woods. Mm-hmm. Apparently Monday, I didn't hear it, but apparently he did an apology. And I was thinking how much he did that whole thing of owning his own shadow, kind of a 12-step sort of thing. But what was interesting to me, it was really well done what he said. But what was interesting was people that called in response, you know, people wanted to keep him there, and that, you know, that it's, you know, it's his own egocentricity or whatever it is about his personality that we do want to scapegoat people. Well, it's an easy thing to do.
And we want scapegoats too, because see, if you keep living your life as a grown adult with too many scapegoats and scapegoats, you're never owning your own goodness, nor are you owning your own evil. And you end up living your life very placid. You know, you don't get the best of both sides.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
You know, while you were talking, and I, at the risk of making you uncomfortable, I'm thinking of Rush Limbaugh and Dick Cheney. Is that, because I don't agree with what they're talking about, is that my evil being projected on them?
Yes. Now let me explain this, because we're getting into areas that we can immediately go right to the head. I'm talking about that everybody you disagree with is an evil. Okay, we can tend to do that. If you don't agree with me, you must be wrong, you must be evil, you must be bad. Thomas Aquinas said that we must learn to love those that we agree with, but that we disagree with, just as much as those we agree with, because both have labored in their search for the truth. Okay? So, the fact that you can so clearly see what's wrong or bad or off about this person or attitude, we can do that. This is where racism begins, okay? Where prejudices begin, is that there is an element of truth, but then we take this bit of truth and we go to the extreme, okay? So I know what I have to do, this is what I have to do, is that when I hear some of these individuals you're talking about, I take a step back and I have to own how strong my emotion is. Because the stronger it is, the more it should be a sign to you of your own inflation. That guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. You know? And to be able to listen and then to learn. Okay, where is this person coming from, and to understand. And you'll know that you're on the right track of working with this, is that your emotions become less and less strong. Doesn't mean your belief system has changed necessarily, but now you can appreciate where this person's coming from because they're tapping something inside of you. Okay? Good example is Christ. He was very angry by injustice, the suffering of God's people. He didn't kill anybody. No, he didn't destroy anybody. The people he was angriest with were us religious authorities. And the reason he was angry was because his perspective is that religious authorities were keeping the people from truly worshiping God in freedom. But he didn't destroy people. He didn't become like them. And so that's the marker for you, is that if you find yourself, you become just as high-pitched or nonsensical, you're ready to explode, you got red in the face, it's like, I've become just like that person. And those are some signs for you that, man, this is probably more about me. And again, it's not in any way disrespecting the other person, nor is it acknowledging that they're right and I'm wrong. You're just saying, it is what it is. And you're working with that. Yes?
Can you speak to lack of forgiveness and holding grudges?
Yes, you're talking, I'm happy to. Forgiveness is a theological term that very simply means let go of your baggage. Let go of what prevents you from moving forward. So like letting go of blame. And to forgive is a process. One of the worst things you can do to your spiritual life is to forgive too quickly. So first off, it's a three-step process. To acknowledge your hurt. To acknowledge very simply that really stung. What you said or what you did, man. And to sit with that. How deep did this hurt go? And that may take longer than you think. When you're ready, you move to step two. And that is to admit your resentment. And that's your desire for revenge. Resentment. It comes from an old Latin word meaning to feel again. And it's how you want to get back at the person. And this is the stage that most nice people want to avoid. Oh, not me. Yes, you. These are all the things that go on in your mind about what you want to do to this person. And you may be really surprised how strong your emotion is. And to sit with that. When you can say, for example, something like this, you know, I'm really tired of carrying through that and I want to move on. Then you can say, you know, Lord, I choose to forgive this person. I ask you to bless them. And I want to thank you for the lessons I've learned in this process. Because forgiveness is a two-way process. The reason that Jesus gave it as a command and not a suggestion is because the key to happiness is the gift you give yourself first, secondarily the other person or the other group. But if you're praying for something like this, you know, Lord, I choose to forgive Marianne, but would you please show her how wrong she was? You have to forgive her. The fourth step, believe it or not, is optional, and that is to seek reconciliation. It would be tremendously prideful for you to go up to the person and say, guess what? I forgave you. We can start a whole other fight. So I usually say to people, you ask God, you know, if you want to be reconciled, you set up the situation. What does that mean? Let's suppose a week after you've gone this whole process, you're feeling at peace, you're in the grocery store, and all of a sudden you hear that familiar voice. Oh, no. Is that God?
Yeah.
God's saying, there she is, go talk to her. Or this person calls you 2 weeks later, out of clear blue. Is that God?
Yep.
So like I said, you just turn over to God and say, if you want me to be reconciled, you open up the door. Because any other approach, it's like, look at how good I am, I'm going to forgive you. Yeah. You know? Allison.
I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but something very close to my heart over the last several years. And named as you name it, how to discern evil. You could take each one of those and apply it to institutional Catholicism mm-hmm. today.
Yeah.
Each one of those, even the Nazi principles of obedience, loyalty, work for the best. I agree with what Richard Rohr says. The best criticism of the bad is the practice of the better, I think is the way I've heard him say it. As lay people, and especially here at Word and Life, this is a wonderful community of people educating themselves in their faith and taking it seriously. We have the ability to do that, to sort of step to the side and practice the better. But I'm asking you, as a priest in the system, teaching seminarians in this system, talk about this to them? Because we are just, you know, projecting it over here and not owning our own shadow and in institutional Catholicism, just what we're doing to the Eucharist alone. Yeah. We call it the source and summit of Catholic prayer life, and we are denying it to people because we're sacrificing it on the altar of a male celibate priesthood. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have to own those things as an evil in the church. I don't even really like the word evil, actually, because it's got so much historical baggage.
Oh, yeah, the other one's blindness. Yeah.
Blindness. You know, you see, these are the exact things that Jesus was criticizing institutional Judaism.
Yeah.
So
you're absolutely right.
Thank you for
and I agree with you. Thank you. You know, Judaism is kind of like the foundational institutional way of living religious life. And because Christianity flowed out of Judaism, we necessarily struggle with the same things. But you're absolutely right. Thank you for seeing that so clearly. When I work with seminarians, this is the word that we use to summarize this whole thing. Entitlement. Okay. In other words, I get or I deserve, and you can fill in the blank. You know, but obviously for seminarians, because I'm a seminarian, or because I'm a priest. And that sense of entitlement gets translated particularly in each of these. Alright? In other words, I don't have to show you my degrees to prove it because I'm a priest. You know? Or I don't have to give you all the reasons we believe we do. Just do it because I said so. I'm a priest. Mm-hmm. See? And without a life partner in our life, there is a real temptation for us males to remain immature. The gift of marriage is you have at least one other person calling you to honesty, holding a mirror up to you and saying, you know, who are you fooling?
And vice versa.
Yeah. So that's why, for example, one of the responses to the clergy scandal was the cardinal has said in this diocese, he said that he does not want to ordain anyone until they have in line not only a spiritual director, but also a priest support group.
What?
Period. So 6 months in advance. And you may say, what's that going to be? A lot. Because the guys who not only were accused, but have, in effect, criminalized other people's lives, had nobody in their life calling them to honesty, mm-hmm. authenticity. You know, and that was part of it, that they were living a, worse than a lone ranger lifestyle, is that they were doing whatever they felt they were entitled to. That people were seen as objects to be used. So yes, we do address this. Yes.
Could you give us some good suggestions on how to get away from this dualistic thinking, which is so embedded in our culture?
Yeah, you know, dualism is a way of looking at life that can bring us some level of comfort. In other words, who's in and who's out? What's up, what's down? You know? Whenever you deal with dualism, there's always going to be something that's seen as being greater than and something lesser than. And it's a starting point, it's not the ending point. And if you read the lives of the mystics, you'll notice that mystics very often are understood better and receive better from other religions than they are their own religion. Mm-hmm. Because typically they're two or three steps beyond the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And the way they talk about their life experience, a lot of us are like, what? Because even the language lives. Because they don't believe in what we believe, they know it. And so that gives them a tremendous freedom. A freedom that opens them up not only to say, but to do things that they don't need the rules anymore. So St. Augustine said, love and do what you will. That the phrasing of their insights is usually very succinct and very clear. So how can we do that? Well, one of the biggest things is to take a look at your prayer form. You know, we're all socialized into prayer by mimicking or copying the words of parents or elders. You know, Our Father who art in heaven. And we're taught this is prayer. That's rote prayer. That's the first step. But if that's the only form of prayer that you're using, that's not going to transform you. You see? The type of prayer that transforms you is the prayer of the saints and mystics, we call prayer of silence, prayer of abandonment, centering prayer, contemplative prayer, where you just sit and look. So I know this is missed on a lot of us, but whatever you see in the sanctuary, whatever liturgy takes place, it's a summary of the faith. It's the way the church says, if you live like this, you will grow in holiness. So, for example, when you remember the days of benediction, the monstrance and all that? The reason we did that, still do, but the reason we did so much then was hopefully we learned to get it. That as you stare at that host long enough, you begin to realize, oh, this is the way I'm supposed to live my life. That I'm not only to show up, but to pay attention to what's in front of me. So that this real presence calls me to be real. So that this essence of Christ calls me to share my essence with the world, you see? But unfortunately, we weren't catechized very well. We just assume everybody got it. But this is mystical thinking, and most of us don't live there. So that's the first thing I would say is, take a look at your prayer forms. If you have most time on the microphone, and God gets very little, you're not going to move into it. Give God credit. He's at least as smart as you are. So He knows what's inside your heart and your soul. Alright. Secondly is, take a look at what your practice is. In other words, in the church we say that worship without justice is empty. Justice without worship doesn't help anybody. So it's that back and forth that we need a place for communal worship, of course, but it's got to be translated into action. So what are you doing to make our world better? That reaches beyond your own family or neighborhood. It could be something small. Something small. But it's amazing how it begins to transform you. St. Paul said that when you help somebody in need, thank them for the privilege, because you've been faced with your own impoverishment. Okay? So those are two big ones. I think the third and final one I'd offer you is to learn how to carry paradox. To carry paradox in your life. And that's the both-and-ness of life. So, you love this person, but you disagree with them. One of my jogging partners, he's a great man. We get into some wonderful political debates. I love this man, but I disagree with him on so many issues. We talk about it. But it also helps keep my feet to the fire. So how can you hold both? You just hold it and let it form you and transform you. So those would be three clear ones. I don't need the whole list, but that will start you on it. And very simply, non-duality is seeing everything as a whole. This is God's creation. If you look at God's creation, there's life and death wherever you look. You know? And it all fits together. This really came home to me years ago when I made a wilderness retreat. Part of it involved a vision quest. And I made this vision quest, this wilderness retreat, when I was entering midlife. And so it's ironic this happened, but we start off in the sweat lodge, and there were three of us who got into a canoe. We'd all divided up, and we weren't supposed to talk. So this guy comes out, he makes these hand signals, would he like some help, you know, pushing the canoe out? So we said yes. So we're sitting there like obedient children with our little bag of stuff, and he pushes us, but he throws us off balance. We all fall in. So we're dripping wet. We can't go back to the cabin. The ironic thing is that we didn't say a word. One woman and two of us men. So there we are, rowing across the lake, soaking wet. We get across, and now it starts to rain. And I was out for 48 hours, and it rained 36 hours straight. So now all my clothes were wet. I found out later that it got so cold and wet that everyone but two of us went back. So I didn't realize this. I really was alone out there. And I remember it was about 36 hours. I didn't have a watch, I guess. But I had been looking in the same 8-foot circle, trying to find God. Now, in the Native American tradition, you're told that an animal will come visit you or something like that. I didn't get any animal. I didn't get an insect. So I'm standing out there getting soaking wet, and I emptied my boots like four times. There's so much rain. And I found myself getting angry. I said, God, it's not fair. I spent so much money to get here. I'm here 8 days, and this is what you do. And I felt the still, small voice say to me, just look. I have been looking. The same friggin' scene. Nothing. Well, the voice was persistent. Just look. So I looked more carefully, the panoramic view. It was a beautiful forest. And I still didn't say anything. The voice persisted. Just look. Hmm. And then I saw it. It was like, oh my gosh. It was right there the whole time. Dead trees, dead leaves. That's what midlife was trying to teach me. I couldn't even see it. Mm-hmm. You see, that's what midlife is all about. You want to keep doing what you've been doing. You just want more of it. Mm-hmm. But God was saying to me through creation, you can't have it both ways. Mm-hmm. You got to learn to become friends with death. There's a time that things need to be let go of. And if you're going to move in the next half of life, you got to let go of the stuff in the first half. And so I thought it was done. Oh yeah, I got it. The voice didn't give up. Look more carefully. So I looked at my sacred circle. Remember, I've been sitting, standing, nailing this for 36 hours. What hadn't I seen? But sure enough, I looked carefully. And it was obvious that many, many years ago, there was a huge tree that had died and fallen down there. And in its place had grown these beautiful, tiny, tiny little plants. Almost microscopic. And there was one little pinprick of a white flower in each of the little leaves. I thought, wow, that's beautiful. One last time, the voice said, look even closer. Right in my sacred circle, years later, there was another large branch that had fallen in a cruciform. Right in my circle was a cross. But it was a living cross. It literally was alive with color and beauty. And I felt like God was saying, this is the promise, that behind every death experience, you will find new life. The past fertilizes the present. Without the past, you wouldn't have it. Mm-hmm. That's okay. That was worth the price of admission. Yeah. So, just like Jacob said when he had his experience with God, God was here all the time. I didn't see him. Mm-hmm. So it is for us. It's easy for us to do what we've just been talking about. To scapegoat others, to project it out, all that. But we're called to do is to notice that God is in the midst of it all. Saving it all. And don't get stuck on that word. It just basically means helping us to move from the negative or the dark or the unforgiven or unredeemed to something new and different. It's always expansive with God. Evil is about restricting. So that's the challenge it's given us. Got time for one more question.
I was looking up at the board before I came in. When I saw evil, you know, looking at it backwards is live.
That's right, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me leave you with that final reflection then from Scripture. It's a great image. Both Mary and Jesus teach us this by their life. And that is that when evil comes at you, it's not about separating or running from it. Is that you get the help that you need to be able to absorb it and then to transform it, much like the Japanese community did for the soldiers. But let's look at it scripturally speaking. Is that Jesus, whatever was given to him, he took within him. He pondered it. All right? And then he gave back something different. It's like a filter. But many people do the reverse, like a lightning rod. Whatever you give to me, I'm giving back to you. Mm-hmm. You call me a name, I'll call you a worse name. All right? You lie about me, I'll lie about you. But to truly be a mature human being means that what comes at me, somehow or another, I'll take it in and I'll really reflect on what part of me is this truth. What part of me doesn't belong to me. Ponder it, work with it, and give back something totally different. That's the work of salvation. This is what makes you a mature believer. Not that you keep learning or turning to Jesus that you do it for me. No. When you begin to do it for yourself and realize Jesus says, come follow me. You will do even greater things than me. Is that you look to him as the model. He will assist you, but he's not going to do it for you. He will take away your maturity if he does that. So the task is given to each of us. To stand up and say, okay, Lord, Help me to be authentically the person you created me to be. Help me to be able to truly ponder what comes at me and not take it personally, not blame somebody else or blame the institution, but to say, okay, what are you trying to show me here? And then give back something totally different. God bless you.
Thank you.